Welcome to episode 37 of the Cancer Pod. In this episode, we're talking about treatment-related skin and nail changes and the integrative approaches we use to address them. So stick around.
I'm Dr. Tina Kayser, and as Leia likes to say, I'm the sciencey one.
And I'm Dr. Leia Sherman, and I'm the cancer insider.
And we're two naturopathic doctors who practice integrative cancer care.
But we're not your doctors.
This is for education, entertainment, and informational purposes only.
Do not apply any of this information without first speaking to your doctor.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast by the hosts and their guests are solely their own.
Welcome to the Cancer Pod. Hi, Tina.
Hi, Leia. We're going to talk about skin and nails.
Yeah. So the various skin side effects from treatments and also, yeah, what happens with the nails?
Mm-hmm.
Weird stuff happens with nails.
Yeah. Weird stuff can definitely happen and does happen.
We can just start right off. I think just starting with radiation is probably the big one, right? I mean, it's not the big one. They're all big ones, but radiation side effects, super common. And again, like a lot of these side effects, if they get really bad, it can delay treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we don't want.
Yeah, I think radiation is a good place to start because it's the most straightforward too, because radiation will affect the skin. External beam radiation, we should be clear, will affect the skin wherever it is hitting the skin to get through into the interior spaces of the body.
And it can also affect the skin where the radiation leaves the body. And so I've had patients with, say, lung cancer who have radiation on their chests, and then on the exit point, they also get a little rash.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of an interesting little tidbit there, is whatever you're applying to the skin on the front at the exit point, apply something there too.
And the radiation oncologist does their best to minimize this effect. So they will often have the radiation beams coming at different angles, whether it's from the side or from the front or at an angle, or there's no guesswork involved in a radiation plan. So there's physicists involved, there's the radiation oncologist that you meet with. This is not left to any guesswork or to chance. And some machines even take into account your breathing pattern. So they'll calculate, you know, where the beam is going according to where you are in your breath. So the precision with which that is planned can certainly inform you as to where on your skin you're going to be exposed. And you can just talk to the radiation oncologist and that person will know exactly where you're going to be likely to have what's called radiation dermatitis.
So that's where we're starting. Let's just take a quick musical break and come right back. All right. So radiation dermatitis, I think where we start as integrative naturopathic providers is with prevention.
Mm-hmm.
So coming up with a regimen for patients to where they are protecting and healing their skin, coming up with a skincare regimen, a skincare routine that is done sometimes even before radiation starts, all the way for a period of time after radiation ends, because radiation side effects continue to happen. The effect of radiation continues to happen even after treatment stops. So continuing with that skin regimen is really important.
Yeah. So while you may not be able to escape it 100%, if we think of it akin to a sunburn, where you kind of have a reddening of the skin when you first get a sunburn, or you can go all the way to blistering and breakage of the skin. What we want to do is just keep it from becoming blistered or having cracks in it. A classic example would be like under the armpit, you know, in your armpit, if you're getting radiation to the upper breast, for example, the armpit might be part of that because that's where the lymph chain goes. And what you want to do is keep it as dry as possible, but without drying out the skin. And you want to keep it clean and just know that the folds of your skin, whether it's, you know, fat tissue or under the arm or wherever we're talking about, is more vulnerable because of the moisture to more cracking of the skin or damage.
Yeah. The word that's used when describing the radiation skin effects when they start to get bad is desquamation, which is just kind of like the outer layers peeling off, and there's wet desquamation, and then there's dry desquamation. So this is something that if it gets really bad, there can be treatment delays. We've had patients sent to wound care to help manage the side effects. So what's your approach to prevention for a patient getting radiation?
I'll give you my ideal approach, and then we can back off from there. Ideally, I have people put together a little combination in a spray bottle. I'll have them do aloe vera gel, and it's food grade. It's sterile. You have to open the bottle. Don't go using your own. You want this to be a sterile source because there is some risk of infection when you have radiation dermatitis. So I'll have them do 50% of aloe vera gel or juice, and then I have them make a little tea of calendula, like a good amount of calendula. And I'm not very precise about the measurements, but if I had to say, I would say a quarter cup of calendula petals in 6 ounces of water steeped like a strong tea. And then I have them put a little rosemary if they happen to have some. I live in the Northwest and a lot of rosemary here grows kind of like a weed. And I know that's true for a lot of the country. So you just take a little snip of your rosemary, you put that in the water. Now the water has been boiled, so it's been sterilized, and you put the calendula and the rosemary in and you let it sit. You add that to the aloe and you spray that on daily. The rosemary is there to keep it from going bad, but I still prefer people put it in the refrigerator. So the rosemary's role is to preserve it a little bit. And I have them make a fresh batch after a couple weeks because I don't want it to have any even possibility of something not sterile in there. And that's why it's in a spray bottle too, so you're not touching it. So that's my ideal.
I like the spray bottle idea. I've recommended that for patients who have received like radiation places where, because I recommend doing compresses, calendula compresses with calendula tea. Mm-hmm. But the spray bottle's nice if you're getting, say, like vaginal radiation or, you know, somewhere where a compress might not necessarily work. Mm-hmm. So I do like the spray bottle.
Yeah, I have also had people create sitz baths. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're getting radiation to the pelvis, it's the most relieving thing. Like I've had people tell me that that brought them more relief from the pain of radiation than the medication.
What do you use? Because I used to recommend that. And I think just the farther that people have gotten from just doing sitz baths in general, the harder it is to find a little tub or something that can hold a tush.
Yeah. Everyone has kind of their own way of doing it. Some people like to put a tub in their bathtub and sit, you know, in there so that they can, you know, if they do splash and stuff, it doesn't matter. And I don't know, I haven't seen this product, but apparently Amazon sells something that you can put on the seat of your toilet that makes life easy. So you just have to put that over the seat of your toilet and you can put your bum in that way. Any type of tub that you can put your bottom in and keep your feet out would work.
Yeah, and just making sure you're safe if you're climbing in out of a tub.
Yeah, I kind of like the idea of the one that can be, you know, your toilet is actually just acting as a somewhere to put it. You're not using it as a toilet. You're using it as just a something you can put the little tub in that you're used to sitting on, and you're going to sit a little lower in that, of course. So that's probably the safer one. Oh, and you know what? I'm going to go ahead and ask someone who has used that, and I'll put it in the show notes. I'll put a link to it.
Oh, okay, to the Amazon.
To the sitz bath. Yeah, to Amazon, I suppose. Yeah.
Okay, nice, nice. Yeah, because I do like to recommend using a calendula tea compress or spray. And then I have that area, you know, padded dry. And then putting on top of that, like a combination of a calendula cream. There's Remedy cream that has dimethicone in it. It's nice. It's super emollient. And so mixing that with the calendula cream and applying that. And then on top of that is where I would have somebody use Aquaphor. So that kind of just seals in that moisture. It's more just holding in those creams. And then the big thing is just making sure that before you get radiation, you're not applying anything to your skin. I know some places say 4 hours between putting something on your skin and getting radiation. And I just think it's safe because you don't want to scrub that area. You really want to be gentle wherever you're getting radiation. I keep gesturing to my breast, which never received radiation, but for some reason, it's just what I'm doing. So yeah, just kind of having, like I said, like a regimen. I've even recommended using a calendula goat's milk soap.
Yeah, calendula is probably the gentlest and the nicest plant to use. It's anti-inflammatory, whether it's a tea, a compress, some in some soap when you're doing routine care. Yeah, calendula is the go-to plant.
I like the goat's milk because it is like very mildly, with the lactic acid, it's mildly exfoliating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's goat's milk, it also contains caprylic acid, which has an antifungal action. Little bonus.
Yeah.
Oh, and the calendula, I can think of three sources that we can mention for calendula. Star West Botanicals sells it in large amounts. Oh, calendula petals don't weigh much. So if you get 8 ounces or 12 ounces or 16 ounces, you're going to get a pretty good size bag.
Yeah, don't go for 5 pounds.
No.
Because you're going to be like selling it. You're going to give it away to people.
So there's Star West, as I mentioned, there's Frontier, and then there's Mountain Rose Herbs, and all of them sell this in bulk.
Yeah, and it's pretty affordable
mm-hmm.
because it is sold by weight, and it's a flower. It's dried flower petals.
Exactly.
You
know, this reminds me of our cancer center would be giving out a cream when women were getting radiation for breast cancer, and my patients would bring the cream in. And what was fascinating to me was that it was a huge dose of vitamin E in the cream, first of all, which I wouldn't do a huge dose of vitamin E during treatment. Afterwards, and after you wait a week after radiation, I would consider it, but I wouldn't do it during treatment. That's me being very conservative. And the other piece was they had parabens. They had fragrances and chemicals in there to preserve it that were estrogenic. And I always thought that was a little unusual. So I actually sent the evidence over to the radiation oncology team over there. And, you know, the nice thing is they listened because they don't want to do their patients any harm. And they ended up changing that. And some of them even sent them my way to get the spray. Because at the time I was actually making the spray for people in my office. So that was just an interesting aside of like, you'd still have to be your own advocate. I mean, we like to think that the idea of estrogens in the environment is something that everyone is looking out for, but that's one of those times that they would have been putting it right on the very area where you don't want to be putting it.
So calendula, pretty much in almost any form. I wouldn't recommend calendula ointment.
Mm-hmm.
It has that sort of Vaseline-y consistency. So it probably takes a little bit more scrubbing to get it off.
Mm-hmm.
And then gel. Don't use calendula gel because it has alcohol. So that would be very drying and stingy.
Right. Yeah, that reminds me, you know, my personal observation has been that when people have, sometimes despite my recommendations, used oil-based anything. It doesn't matter if it's Vaseline or if it's beeswax and olive oil. My observation has been radiation dermatitis, which basically looks like a sunburn or worse, first degree or second degree sunburn. It's worsened by the use of anything that has an oil base to it. That's been my observation personally, even though studies have refuted that and that there's no quote unquote evidence that oil-based products are supposed to worsen it. And I say that because there was one in particular that was supposed to be like a CBD salve, you know, and salves are generally olive oil and beeswax or some other base mm-hmm. that's similar natural ingredients. I wouldn't recommend it. It's doing what mineral oil or what do we use baby oil back in the 70s?
Baby oil. Just rub some butter on it.
Yeah.
Put a butter on a burn.
That's just it. I mean, I don't care what the evidence says. My observation was the opposite, that only had honestly and truly, only so many patients. I mean, not a lot of patients have gone on to second degree burns and blisters and like actual severe burns in my practice. So those people that did were more likely to be those kind of going off the map and using those kind of products that are salve type things.
Well, what's interesting is Aquaphor is very much with that consistency of petroleum jelly, and that's kind of what is recommended.
Maybe that explains why the evidence didn't show it.
Yeah. So I think that information is interesting because, yeah, Aquaphor is pretty standard as to what's used during radiation. But that's why I like it on top of all of those other more healing lotions, because it's used as an occlusive. It's like holding in the moisture. It's kind of protecting it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I recommend using the Aquaphor. Oh, I've had patients who kind of go off on their own and they've used emu oil before
mm-hmm.
and they claim it works. So I have no idea what or how one gets oil from an emu, if it is actually emu oil. But yeah, I've had patients use some pretty interesting oils. I mean, ultimately, if you shower and you're able to not scrub the radiation site, there maybe there isn't harm in that. You just don't want any oils on your skin prior to radiation.
I completely agree with that.
That's like basting a turkey.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the same reason. I don't know. Have you ever been out in the sun and for whatever reason, you know, for me, I might be grilling or something and I get oil on my hands. And if I touch my leg or my arm, I tan pretty readily. And I'll be like, what's with the blotch of darkness right there? And I'll realize it was oil. Like I'm in the sun and I put a little blotch of oil on my arm or my leg, it will tan up significantly more than what's around it. So it's kind of the same idea.
That's never happened to me.
Oh, you don't tan easily. Is that why?
I tan easily. I just don't like, I think our grills are always in the shade.
Oh yeah. You're probably just
I don't splash hot oil on myself. Wait a minute. I'm not even doing the grilling. What am I talking about?
That's
why. I'm sitting back on the lounge chair. I know. I'm a slacker.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So let's move from radiation dermatitis to something that's really interesting that may happen to some people. And that is radiation recall.
Yeah.
So someone may have received radiation a period of time prior, and then they get systemic treatment. Maybe it was a taxane. Maybe it was doxorubicin or gemcitabine. And the area that had been previously irradiated and healed, suddenly that redness comes back.
It's clearly the radiation field too. I mean, you can see the line of the radiation field. And when people have radiation recall, and you're like, it's kind of a wild effect that the body can react that way. Because there's no radiation happening. It's just the chemo.
Right. It's just your body remembering. That's why it's called radiation recall. It's your body remembering that there was radiation. And for some reason, certain drugs can trigger it to come back. So yeah, that's kind of a little fascinating occurrence that can happen.
And you can treat that topically, just like we mentioned things for radiation dermatitis. You can still treat that the same way topically.
So then moving on from radiation, there are these rashes. There are certain drugs, EGFR inhibitors is what they're known as. And those can trigger a rash and it looks a lot like acne. And they're kind of like these different phases in the rash where it goes from just like a redness to papulopustular lesions, which looks like acne with a little head. Do not pick it. Do not. And then that kind of crusts over. And then there's just kind of like this general redness or like they call them telangiectasia, which is like spider veiny kind of redness that happens. So yeah, the monoclonal antibodies, cetuximab is the big one, but there are other mAbs as well. And then the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and those are the NIBs, so like erlotinib, those are the ones that can result in this rash.
Yeah, and those are, like you mentioned, that EGFR inhibitors, they're targeting that particular receptor on the cells. And so that's what, that's a lot of colorectal cancer and lung cancer and several other cancers.
Breast, head and neck, and pancreatic, I think, are the big ones. Yeah. So the standard of care for that treatment, typically an oral antibiotic and some steroid cream. I go for calendula. This is going to be a really like a promotion for calendula this episode. But that, yeah, I kind of encourage calendula, not doing anything harsh, not using products with alcohol. Don't use your skin toner or anything like that. Don't use anything that you would use on acne because it's not the same thing. It's not caused by a bacteria the way that acne can have the bacteria related to it. It doesn't become infected unless those pustules are opened and, you know, that's the way that they become more infective.
Yeah. And that can happen anywhere. So it can happen on the arms, it can happen on your back, it can be anywhere. It's going to be both sides of the body, though. It's not going to happen on one side, not the other usually. So I came across one study using a specific plant that grows kind of in the Mediterranean region. I guess it's a traditional plant in Turkey. Pistaceae terebinthus is its Latin name. I don't know its common name. I looked on Wikipedia. That was no help.
Thanks, Wikipedia, for nothing.
Thanks for nothing. So they used a soap with this plant in it. It seemed to be effective to reverse some of the symptoms of the acneiform rash that happens with this whole EGFR inhibitor class of drugs. So I thought that was interesting. But other plants that we use traditionally just for skin health are things like plantain.
Lavender,
borage. What else? We might use topically. We do use St. John's wort topically, but not internally.
So this soap, is this something that's commercially available, or is this just something that was made for a study?
It was just used in a study. I haven't seen a product on the market that's using it.
Okay. So anything else for the rash? I mean, again, it's like not using anything drying. I think at one point I did recommend trying coconut oil because it does have antimicrobial properties, you know, just using a little bit. I think I recommended that for a while.
I think coconut oil will act a lot differently than the other oils because it won't sit on top. Coconut oil, being a medium chain triglyceride that's a saturated fat, is able to be transported through the dermis better. So it doesn't just sit on top like mineral oil.
Okay, so the next big skin effect that... surprise, guess who experienced it? I did. Thank you. Hand-foot syndrome.
Oh, did you have hand-foot syndrome too?
Yeah. Thank you, Taxol.
Wow.
Yeah, and I actually had to Google. I remember Googling it to be like, does Taxol cause hand-foot syndrome? And yes, it does. It can. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So the one that we think of most with hand-foot syndrome, and that is a reddening of the palms and the soles of the feet, and it's painful. They feel scalded often, and they can peel. Mm-hmm. And one crazy side effect, which did not happen to me, is you can actually lose your fingerprints from this phenomena. Then, you know, that could lead to a whole life of crime. I mean, really, or being a spy.
Yeah. There's a novel waiting to be written right there. Yeah,
absolutely. So, so the big one that causes this rash is capecitabine or Zoloda. And kind of that whole like 5-FU family is known for that. Also, Adriamycin or doxorubicin. And then its other form, Doxil. I've seen it more with Doxil. I don't think I've really seen it with doxorubicin. And then Taxotere and Taxol. And then certain targeted therapies. And yeah, it can be pretty debilitating because it is very painful. It can be the soles of your feet. And so anywhere where there's a lot of pressure or friction, so the bottoms of your feet, your hands, it's no fun. It's absolutely no fun.
Yeah.
The big thing to prevent it, or to reduce the risk, I should say, is avoiding heat. So really for anything that can cause a skin effect, just not doing super hot showers, being really careful with, if you're washing dishes, not to use hot water. And if you do wear gloves when washing dishes, make sure that they're lined. So if they're rubber gloves, don't have the rubber directly on your skin because that's just going to hold in the heat. So make sure they're those cotton lined gloves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a good way to get out of doing dishes.
That's the hard way of getting out of dishes.
It is the hard way. But yeah, so I used a compounded cream that had aloe and urea. So urea is what has been studied the most. And urea is typically found for these creams like at a 10%, what you want is a 10% urea cream. And the studies were showing that you start using it even before the rash forms, like just keep it on your hands, your feet.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that can be found over the counter in Eucerin is a brand, you know, like there's certain like working hands, like there are all these different brands that people have used. Another product are like creams with ceramides also.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so starting to use the creams, especially the urea, even before the rash starts is important to use it as prevention.
Right.
Or risk reduction.
Right. And that's for the hand foot syndrome specifically.
Oh, and then there's always the studies with B6, vitamin B6, peroxidine, as they call it.
Yeah. So they use peroxidine, which is not the active form of B6, but that is what was used in the studies. And it was generally what? It was a high dose of it.
200 milligrams or 400 milligrams, like really, really high doses.
Mm-hmm. It's not something you want to take forever after, because B6, if you take it indefinitely at that kind of dose, will probably give you a B6 toxicity over time. So once treatment is over, and that's, those studies were done alongside 5-FU or Xeloda specifically, but once the treatment is over, you should stop that high dose for sure.
And some people can be on those treatments for a really long time.
Xeloda especially, yeah.
Yeah. So the B6 thing, I don't know. I mean, they're studies, but it's not something that you just take willy-nilly.
I agree. Yeah.
I wonder if there's ever a topical B6 that's been used.
I haven't seen anything, but we can look it up.
Yeah. And I'm a big fan. I should look it up too, but I'm a big fan of niacinamide topically, which is a form of niacin, just in general for skin. So that's something else that I would love to look up to see if that's been used for the rash, the EGFR inhibitor rash. Stuff to think about.
Yeah. The other class of drugs that we should touch on is the immune checkpoint inhibitors. That's that Opdivo, nivolumab, Yervoy. Checkpoint inhibitor drugs are being used. And this is the kind of the big latest and greatest in the immune therapies out there. A lot of them have various skin manifestations. So one of the things that we think about with that whole checkpoint inhibitor class of drugs is that they can cause autoimmune reactions. So sometimes if you're already prone to something like psoriasis, or you're prone to scleroderma, it'll kind of be the last, think of it as a straw that tips the scale into that direction, and it can set off an actual autoimmune response. So that's probably the biggest thing to be on the lookout for. There's some pretty severe reactions that are less common than an autoimmune derived skin reaction. It can look like anything from blisters to eczema, but this is very real and usually is treated with topical agents, as far as I know. And as any side effects from this drug class, there's also a certain level of steroids that are used, because what they do is they'll suppress the immune function. So there'll be a controlled suppression to minimize symptoms if they get out of hand. So I just want to mention that that's also possible, that entire class of drugs.
Yeah, I don't know if I've seen that, but I haven't. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you have.
I don't think it's common. I think it's the underlying autoimmunity that sometimes is unmasked. I see that much more commonly. I mean, that's not uncommon to have some autoimmune condition arise when you're on these drugs. But skin manifestations I have not seen as commonly at all, but they do happen.
One thing that can happen, which is another really interesting side effect, is that hyperpigmentation. And it's more noticeable in people with darker complexions. And it can be like palms just turning black. Like people always say, like, my hands just constantly look dirty. There can also be hyperpigmentation underneath the nails. And those are temporary, mostly. Sometimes the nails, it takes longer for that to go away. But typically after that particular treatment is stopped, it does resolve. But it doesn't necessarily have to be on the hands. It could be elsewhere too. It's just getting these spots of darker pigment. 5-FU especially is, I would say, guilty of that, as is Taxotere, and then doxorubicin and cyclophosphamide can also cause that.
Yeah. I think I've seen it most with Taxotere. I mean, if I had to think about it in my patients in the past, and then nails get very tender. And sometimes people take to, you know, putting tape on them because they don't want to touch anything, and they don't want the nail bed raises up, eventually having the nail fall off.
That's the nail section, Tina.
Oh, sorry.
We're heading to the nail section. We're still in skin.
Oh, right.
That's...
Well, we should segue over.
So we still have a couple more things we want to cover. Photosensitivity, that is huge. Just making sure you're always using like a sunblock, wearing sun protective clothing, wearing a big hat, because there are treatments that will make you more prone to burning. So
yeah,
photosensitivity, and then you'll have to go and use calendula because you have a burn. So we're bringing it full circle. And then the last thing is just, and it is a really big thing that I hear from patients, is just dry skin. Just everything feels dry. Again, using moisturizers that do not contain perfumes or alcohol is important. I am a fan of using either like sweet almond oil or sesame oil or even coconut oil just directly on the skin, being careful that you're not going to slip in the shower or the bathroom. So don't slather it on, just using a little bit of that. That's probably just more that Ayurvedic way of addressing it. The creams with ceramides. Yeah. Not using hot water, like I said before.
Mm-hmm.
Staying hydrated.
Yeah. So I think that pretty much covers it for skin.
Yeah. There definitely are some other things that happen that are a little less common, but let's take a break and then we'll come back to nails. We'll talk about all the fun stuff that happens with nails.
All right. Stay tuned.
Biotin is commonly found in nail and hair formulas. Did you know that it can interfere with some common lab tests? Always hold biotin supplements at least 3 days before a lab draw and let your provider know what supplements you're taking.
Okay, Tina, why do we even have nails?
I mean, it's basically a protection.
Yeah. So I actually looked it up because I was like, why do we have nails? So it does add strength. If you think about it, it adds strength to your fingertips and to your toes. And so if you were to touch something, like your little fingertip won't go backwards. Ew. Ew.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, just like dropping things on it, whatnot. So yeah, so it is protection.
You know, I'm thinking about that protection thing and you're right. I sliced my thumb and what?
Go on.
I sliced my thumb
I'm
at
cringing.
A home. Yeah. Is that why? Oh, I'm like, what? Oh yeah. No, I sliced it at Home Depot on basically aluminum that was sticking out on a display.
Oh no. Okay. Ew.
Hopefully no one's having dinner right now. And ultimately I remember just being like, one, going to the bathroom. But I also thought to myself, if my nail wasn't there, right? I mean, it is kind of an amazing piece of protection.
Yeah. And it's that keratin, right? It's super, super strong. It's what hooves are made out of.
Yeah.
Keratin is why rhinos have horns and horses have hooves. And so do other animals. I don't want to leave anyone out.
You don't want to offend any animals?
Offend any animals by leaving them out. So just hooved animals. That's all keratin. And the cool thing about fingernails is that looking at them, you can actually tell if someone has nutritional deficiencies by just looking at nails. And there are charts out there. We could post one in the show notes. It's such a cool thing.
So just yesterday, funny you should say that, I just bought a book, an old medical book that is all about nails, how they look and when they're ridging vertically or horizontally or...
Nail diagnosis.
Nail diagnosis. What we used to use before we had high-tech imaging devices and laboratory values to go by. I mean, nails were a big tell for what was going on internally. So we still use it a lot. We use nail diagnosis a lot.
Yeah. And going through treatments, those treatments themselves can change your nails. And so whether it's the nutritional deficiencies where you get the ridges or there are those... the horizontal ridges that happen, like you can see like, oh, at this point is where I started chemo.
Yes.
Or whatever systemic therapy that I'm receiving. And there's like a definite horizontal line across the nail. So nails are really, they're really, really cool.
Those horizontal lines are called Bowes lines, and Bow spelled as in boyfriend, Bow.
B-E-A-U. But well, it could be girlfriend too. They could be a Bow. Who's your Bow? No. Is Bow always used with boyfriends?
I don't know. I think so.
I just thought it was like you're like the person you're enamored with. Who's your beau? I don't know these things. Are you Googling it?
You know, I'm the wrong person to ask. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know these things, but you can sometimes see when people are going through treatment, and this will happen. You know, we just went through COVID. If you had a severe case of COVID, you can see a horizontal line. It basically just symbolizes or shows in your nail bed. It'll indent horizontal because your body's under so much stress at that time, physical stress, whether it's a severe infection or it's chemotherapy or starvation. It could be a lot of things, right? You'll get this horizontal line. It's pretty cool to see because you just know what the body is kind of retracting, you know? So it's kind of interesting that the nail retracts because I think of it that way, like conserving energy.
So I had those, surprise, surprise. And yeah, it was so interesting to watch it grow out, you know? It's like, get out of my body. It took forever. My nails take forever to grow. But other things that can happen is the nails become very brittle and dry. They can split not only horizontally, but vertically.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned color changes. People develop nail fungus more easily. And then nail loss. Nail loss is the big thing. Well, they're all big things, but nail loss is, you know, especially losing toenails. Yeah, that happened to me too.
Yeah. And there, you lost nails?
My big toenails. Yeah. So my oncologist recommended that I use cryotherapy. So we did not have those fancy boots or gloves. I just used biohazard bags that were filled with ice that the nurses brought, and I would alternate, you know, I wouldn't keep them on the whole time, but when I was getting Taxotere, I would kind of rotate them off and on, not only for neuropathy, but also to preserve my nails. And it worked. I did get discoloration of my fingernails, and then I lost both of my big toenails.
Hmm. Was it painful?
Well, you know.
Yeah. It didn't hurt.
Didn't hurt. Well, you know what's crazy is that because you don't lose them right away. I mean, the other toenail starts to come in and push it out, the new toenail. And then you just have this thick area. And so shoes would hurt because I had a double thick toenail.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, using good hygiene. Don't go get manicures. Don't have people cutting your cuticles. Just being really gentle is important. There are different medications that you can take if you do get nail fungus.
Mm-hmm.
There are oral medications. Those can be really hard on the liver, but there are topical prescription medications that can be painted on your nails, and those take time. I had one patient whose brother told them to soak their toes in Guinness.
My goodness.
And you can look on the Google. It's actually a thing. You can use Guinness, which seems like kind of an expensive beer to me. I don't know how much it costs, but it just seems like a fancy beer. Like, it's not like it's PBR. It's Guinness. And apparently that works for nail fungus.
All right. I got my doubts about that, but I know vinegar works and it's cheaper.
I'm going to find something about Guinness and I'm going to post it. I don't think it's a clinical trial, but.
Well, and they must have something super special in it, because when you think about it, you know, Guinness is made by a yeast. And there's yeast nutrient in it. And we're talking about a toenail fungus. So kind of we're staying in the fungi family here, or fungi kingdom. So anyways, it seems odd that something that can grow one fungus is going to kill another.
Well, maybe it's a battle of the fungus.
Maybe it is.
They duke it out in your nails.
Saccharomyces cerevisiae puts out something that kills other funguses because it's dominant.
But it's something special in Guinness.
Well, anyways, it's a lot cheaper to buy white distilled vinegar by the gallon.
And you dilute it. Yeah, it's diluted.
50-50.
Oh, I heard 4-1. Or like 4 water, 1.
Oh.
Because I saw this in a continuing ed.
Oh, 4-1.
And they recommended 1 part vinegar to 4 parts water. Yeah. So, you know, experiment.
So at least 4-1, all the way up to 1-1.
Depends on how flush you are with your vinegar supply.
And how much you can stand the smell of it, because, you know, it's pretty pungent.
It's vinegary. So again, with how I mentioned the cryotherapy, that is a recommendation for, you know, that you will find in kind of conventional resources. And with the caution not to use it with hematologic malignancies such as leukemia and lymphoma, because of the risk of circulating cancer cells. And by putting that ice on that area, you are reducing potentially any treatment that can go to that area. So
mm-hmm. I have to circle back. I know how I prescribe it, but what did you hear in the lecture? How do they suggest you prescribe it for a patient, like the duration and frequency?
I don't remember. It was an online CE thing. I was trying to get all my credits for my license at the end of the year. So I'm sure I have the notes somewhere. It was really interesting because there were a bunch of dermatologists talking about, oh, I should have referred to it actually for the rest of this episode, but I just remembered it with the vinegar when you mentioned it. But yeah, they kind of covered like the things. And I thought the vinegar was really cool because it was kind of something that's accessible to people.
Yeah. Yeah. I have had people, because toenail funguses tend to happen more frequently, and I will have people get a Rubbermaid, you know, or some kind of bin you could put your toes in at the very least comfortably, do the mix, whether it's 4-1 or 1-1 of vinegar and water into the bin. And then after, like, have a shower at night instead of the morning, and then have nice clean feet, go into the bedroom, soak your toes in this stuff. You don't have to soak your whole foot. You can just soak your toes. But you can reuse it you don't have to make it fresh every single day. You can reuse it, put the cap on it, and then reuse it for that week, and then freshen it up again. Cause, you know, if you feel like it's getting dirty or you're not able to shower before each time, you want to freshen it up faster. But I'm saying that because you have to do it every single day for months and months and months and months while you wait for the nails to grow out. It works, but it takes some dedication when you're doing a topical treatment of any kind, actually, because you're waiting for the nail to keep continually grow out.
that's how it is with the, what's it called? Penlac, I think, is the prescription. You know, you have to keep reapplying it. And then at the end of a week, you like remove it with alcohol and then you start all over. I was using that and I stopped after a while because I wanted to paint my nails for something and then I'm not going to take off the nail polish. I mean, it got to be a lot, but maybe the vinegar, maybe I'll try vinegar. Yes, that happened to me too.
I didn't say it. I thought it though.
I know. I'm like a poster child for side effects. So things that people try, biotin, which I don't really know what the evidence is. I did try biotin for my nails and they got really, really hard and brittle from taking it. So I stopped using it because they were actually cracking because of the biotin. Because that was the only thing that was doing different. You hear people will do collagen or even like Knox gelatin, which I think I've mentioned previously. That was a big nail thing that my mom did back in the 70s. You know, I mean, I'm not really a big fan of. I think we talked about that.
Yeah, we probably talked about it in our collagen episode. I don't think we talked about nail health in the collagen episode, though. We just talked more skin.
But yeah, people have formulas. Companies have formulas that have collagen in them. What I used during treatment was something called Hoof Alive, which was recommended by, I don't remember who recommended it, actually. I would go to this feed store where I would get stuff for my chickens, and they sell this product, and you could buy it in huge tubs for your horses, or you could buy them in little tiny like containers for your own nails. And it has lanolin in it. And you apply it, I don't know, it was a couple times a day or a couple times a week. I don't even remember at this point. But yeah, I mean, it's supposed to help with your nails. If it's good enough for a horse's hoof, it's good enough for me.
There's that for sure. When you said horse hooves, it reminded me. I recommend to patients that they avoid glyphosate, which is Roundup, because there is some evidence to show that the compound in Roundup or glyphosate is disruptive to connective tissue, skin, hair, nails, hooves of horses.
So don't apply Roundup to your nails or hair during treatment.
So a lot of people use Roundup in and around their house to control weeds. It's really commonly used. So I'll ask the people just avoid the use of that too. I mean, I ask people avoid it anyways, but strange as it is, sometimes you have to motivate people with what they're concerned with, not with what you're concerned with. There's a lot of reasons to avoid Roundup. And strange as it may be, nail health might be the reason someone does it. As a clinician, I'm listening to the patient and trying to, you know, help them out in every way possible. But that's something that I have done before. It was like, oh yeah. Because I'm thinking to myself, I'm thinking back to some conversation I probably already had with that person where they're using this stuff or they're landscapers or something. And I'll be like, oh, and by the way, if this is your concern, you're undoing some of the good stuff we're doing by using that product.
You know what you can use instead of Roundup? White vinegar.
Oh, for the plants.
Yeah. For killing weeds. I used to buy one of those little pump things from like Ace Hardware and I'd fill it with white vinegar. I used it straight. I think you're supposed to dilute it and mix some soap, dish soap in there too. It was the desert.
Yeah.
I used it straight and I would pump it and spray it right on the weeds and then pull them out. So white vinegar.
It's a defoliant. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by white vinegar. And then, yeah, if you do it and it's sunny, like in the Arizona sun, that'll fry them right up. Those weeds will go away.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. I have used it that way too, as a defoliant. You can get 20% vinegar now. You can even get 30%.
Just blast them.
What we buy. Yeah. You just blast them. Yeah. It does work better when it's nice and concentrated. I think what we buy under the counter is a lot less than that. You know, like what you put in a kitchen, like distilled vinegar.
Yeah, I get the big things from Costco and just pour it in. Yeah. And I think you're supposed to use soap because like a little bit of dish soap because that helps it kind of stick to the leaves. Is that what the point is? Yeah.
I think so. That's my assumption.
Yeah. But if you drown them. Anyways, this has kind of gone off topic and we're let's do a whole episode on gardening tips and the 101 uses for white vinegar. So I do have a song. I have a song for this episode.
All right.
So it's originally this episode was just skin and we were going to do hair and nails and then we moved nails over. So now the song is more related to skin. It's I've Got You Under My Skin by Frank Sinatra. I will post a video. I will post a link. It'll be on Spotify, blah, blah, blah. So we are punchy. We have done a lot of work today.
Mm-hmm.
If you find any of this information helpful, then let us know. Again, we aren't your doctors. We're not prescribing anything. We're just talking.
And hopefully you're listening.
And share this with friends, family, loved ones, total strangers. I did. I met somebody and got into a conversation with someone, and it came up that there was this podcast called The Cancer Pod because I mentioned it. So
nice.
You never know. You never know.
You never know.
On that note, I'm Dr. Leah Sherman.
And I'm Dr. Tina Kayser.
And this is The Cancer Pod.
Until next time.
Thanks for listening to The Cancer Pod. Remember to subscribe, review, and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social media for updates. And as always, this is not medical advice. These are our opinions. Talk to your doctor before changing anything related to your treatment plan. The Cancer Pod is hosted by me, Dr. Leah Sherman, and by Dr. Tina Kayser. Music is by Kevin MacLeod. See you next time.
Ended already.